Hello and welcome to episode 66 of Connectivity. I'm Scott Thompson. We've got two segments for you today. The first main segment is all about our Game of the Year choices. That's with myself, Neil, and Nicholas Bray. And after the outro, we have a special bonus segment all about the Doctor Who Christmas special. That's with me, Amanda Albert, and David Egolf. Enjoy.
Welcome to Connectivity's end of the year stuff. We'll probably do another one of these because a lot of our regular crew bailed. But let's focus on who made it this week. I'm your host, Neil Ronahan, and with me, as pretty much always, Scott Thompson.
Hello!
And we've got a visitor from the land down under, Nick Bray.
Hello.
And I guess this is also fortuitous because Nick just put out NWR Powered Off issue number one, which is really cool. Nick, do you want to talk about that for a little bit before we get into Game of the Year stuff?
Sure. There's not much more to say than what's on the site, most likely. But what do you guys think of it, the finished product?
I think it's really cool. If I had a tablet, I think it would hold a lot more value to me, but I just love the way it looks.
Yeah, the design took a little while. Like, it took a while to get all of the text in and stuff. It was sort of longer than I imagined it was going to, actually.
There's been a lot of a lot of those kind of layout things in my life recently. I guess as we're talking about those such things, I'm a part of that Nintendo Force thing that you might have heard about. And it was kind of funny because both things kind of were developing at the same time. And I couldn't really tell the other group about the other thing. And I was just like, but this is funny because there's two, like, print things going on with me at the same time.
Yeah, I was like, when they announced that, I was like, Neil, he would have known back in August or whatever.
Yeah. No, because that's part of the reason why I took a little more of a hands-off approach with it.
Yeah.
Because it was like I was literally doing the same thing. but I'm not even, I mean, as far as for anyone who's curious, my role on Nintendo Force is more that I'm contributing writing to it than anything else. That's pretty much Lucas Thomas's baby, and I'm just helping it along.
You're one of the grunts.
Yeah. I did get to write about Goof Troop for it.
There you go.
Because like the Nintendo Power staple of like the retro game that they discussed, so I got to talk about Goof Troop and how it's like Shinji Mikami's precursor to Resident Evil and all that jazz. And then I get to talk about Who Framed Roger Rabbit on the Game Boy on the sidebar. That's pretty awesome. But anyway, we're here to talk about games of 2012 and pretty much the year as a whole. So what we're going to do first is we're each going to go around. We'll start with our guest and then go to Scott and then go to me. And we'll go through our top five one by one. And then after that, we'll discuss some Nintendo games as kind of a break from this Nintendo nonsense. And then we'll go through the games that we didn't talk chronologically throughout the year as kind of a modified that Nintendo year for 2012. So let's start off. Nick, what's your number five game?
Okay. I haven't got that many games from this year that I've actually played. So my number five is going to have to be Art of Balance Touch for the Nintendo 3DS. Balancing platforms and stuff on rocks is decidedly fun.
Yeah. I think it's a really cool little game. I played the demo of the WiiWare version. I was always kind of interested in it, and I ended up picking this up mostly for the plane ride home from E3. that I really enjoyed what I played of it, although I know there's a considerable amount of that game that I haven't played because there's a lot of it in that game.
Yes, it's pretty lengthy.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not much really to say, but...
Yeah, you balance stuff. It's pretty cool.
The 3Ds is pretty nice, I guess.
Yeah. Scott, have you ever played this game in any of its forms?
No, I haven't.
Maybe you should. I think there might be actually a demo on the 3DS eShop.
Yeah, that's how I played it over here. I don't know if there's a demo on the American eShop, though.
Yeah, I think it might be. Or I think it might have came to Europe first and it might have come to America later. I don't know, because I'd already bought the game by the time the demo would have been out. But, cool. So, Scott, what's your number 5 game?
My number 5 game has to be Lego Batman 2.
Really?
This game is awesome. It's so good.
What system are you playing it on?
I originally played it on PS3.
But it is a Wii game, so it counts.
Yeah, it is a Wii game. I'm fairly certain the Wii game is pretty much the PS3 game.
But without HD. Maybe some Wackle. But... Who knows?
Yeah, maybe.
So what makes this game so much better than all the other LEGO games? Because this is a game that, like, I was looking forward to LEGO Batman, the first one, and I thought it was kind of disappointing. Like, it just, what kind of killed me about that game is that most of, like, the LEGO Star Wars and LEGO Indiana Jones succeeded because you had those moments from those movies that were very distinct that then they replayed in LEGO form, and, you know, it's cute and it's fun, and it's nice replaying those moments from a kind of lighthearted perspective.
Mm-hmm.
But LEGO Batman, it was just this hodgepodge of just, like, Batman as a whole, and it wasn't engaging at all, and
sure.
It just felt boring.
Sure. Well, you especially, Neil, would love this, because it's, like, an homage to just the DC universe.
Awesome.
It pulls in, like, the entire Justice League, really.
Yeah. Yeah, because I know Superman and Green Lantern and everything, that's kind of the hook of it.
Right, and I mean, even it goes even deeper. I mean, like, Cyborg's in it.
That's because he's in the new Justice League, so
sure.
They're trying to whore him out everywhere.
Exactly, yeah, and even some other kind of, like, maybe more minor characters, I guess you could say, or less known than just Batman and Superman. And it's an entirely original story. That sees, like,
they're actually making that into a movie in June. I'm pretty sure it's just that story.
That's awesome, because it's really good, and what really sets this game apart from, like, the other LEGO games is they've always had, like, a little bit of a sense of humor, but this is the first one that's entirely voice acted, and the voice cast just, like, kills it, and it's just a really funny game. I mean, it pokes fun at just a lot of, like, DC lore and just sort of some of the, like, I don't know, I guess things you have to overlook when it comes to superheroes, you know?
Yeah.
Like, that between each level, there's always a news report, and the news anchor kind of, like, slyly, like, pokes holes in, like, the events that are going on, and, like, you know, we'll joke that, you know, like, why don't you ever see, like, Bruce Wayne and Batman together, or, like, oh, how convenient that Batman was at that Bruce Wayne fundraiser to stop the Joker, and just, like, stuff like that, and Batman and Superman have great banter, because Batman is super jealous of Superman, and, like, hates that he has all these abilities, and, like, is unstoppable. Meanwhile, Robin is, like, in love with Superman, and, like, swoons over him.
Which Robin is it? Is it Dick Grayson, or Tim Drake, or does it even make sense to you at all?
No, I mean, I'm somewhat familiar with the different Robins. I think it's Dick Grayson, but I'm not 100% positive, so I could totally be wrong.
It could just be Gennaro Robin.
Yeah, well, they do have like parts where they're not in their costume, so I'm pretty sure it's Dick Grayson, but
yeah,
again, not 100% positive. But yeah, it was just a fun game. I was really surprised. I played a handful of LEGO games, but this one was really great. I played a co-op with my girlfriend the entire way through, and just a lot of fun, and between levels, there's the whole open world Gotham City where you can explore and find things and just do a variety of things, and I'm very pleasantly surprised. Very good. And Neil, as a DC fan, you really should track this down. It's got to be cheap now.
Especially since, like, I mean, you talk real positive about it around when it came out, but the fact that it made your top 5 for the year, that makes me really, really consider looking into checking this out at some point. I think, with PlayStation Plus, there's, like, an hour game trial that I might have downloaded. I might check that out and see if I could find it cheap.
You should.
But I'm looking forward to the movie when it comes out, because I like DC animated movies for the most part, unless they're cheap pieces of crap like Superman Brainiac Attacks. Because, you know, everyone knows about that, right?
Sure, sure.
Yeah. The story's pretty good, too. I mean, I think I talked about it before, and you said it was sort of lifted from a different comic at some point, but Batman has his supply of kryptonite stolen from him by the Joker and Lex Luthor.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's based on something
right.
in the past.
So he helps Superman to defeat them, and yeah, so good stuff.
Yeah, cool. So my number five is Little Inferno, which is a Wii U eShop game that came out the day the system launched, and I just found that game to be completely fantastic.
Is that what Lauren was playing?
Yeah. Lauren's actually, she's playing Little Inferno right now. And I mean, it's not a long game, it's only like 3 hours long, but it's really one of my favorite experiences in a long time, because it's this very deceptively simple game, and that like, you're just burning things. But then there's this puzzle element, because you need to burn the different combos of things. And you'll just be given, like, a name, like, it'll be, like, someone else's combo. And then you need to look to see, like, okay, I have something that's someone else's family portrait and someone else's credit card, so if I burn those together, then I get the combo.
Mm-hmm.
And that gets increasingly difficult, because at first you just have one page of a catalog, and then you get more pages, and that opens up the possibilities for combos, and I think there's something like 100 in total. And then you basically have that puzzle element drives the game, but along the way there's this really weird story that develops and kind of comes to a head at the end in a really fantastic, like, half an hour finale that, I mean, it just says a lot about, like, life, the universe, and everything as it pertains to video games. And it's just a really, really cool game, and it is definitely very, very reminiscent of World of Goo. And I think if you like that game, at least, maybe not necessarily the gameplay, but the sensibilities of that game, and that story also took some weird turns, too, then you should definitely check out Little Inferno. And it's, I mean, it beat out a lot of quality games to get into this number five spot, and it really wasn't even that much of a competition, because I just love this game that much.
Yeah, it was very good. And I agree, if you like World of Goo's, like, aesthetic, then I think this game's for you. World of Goo's is much more a game, I think. I mean, it's a puzzle game. There's a lot more you have to put into it, but
I like this game way more than World of Goo. I mean, I enjoyed World of Goo, but it did kind of like get more interesting once you hit like the kind of twist in World of Goo.
Mm-hmm.
But it took me a while to get to there, because it's just like, I played a lot of it and I was just kind of like, this is just the same stuff, but it gets more confusing. And I actually didn't really think the pointer controls were as precise as some people claim them to be. But,
yeah.
I mean, it was still a great game, but it didn't really grab me as much as Little Inferno did. Because this was a game where, you know, among the Wii U launch, it basically just dominated my playtime for like 2 nights. And I ended up, you know, stayed up incredibly late 2 nights in a row to finish it off.
Right. Well, they have like two different, like, I don't know, philosophies almost. Like, World of Goo could become very difficult, like you're saying, and very hard to progress. Whereas Little Inferno, there's always that push to keep going, because it is so easy to just get sucked in, and before you know it, you played an hour and a half. You know, there's always that, well, if I just do one more thing, then I get the next page, or I'll get the next, you know, thing I can burn, or I think I figured out what this combo is, and yeah, it's a very fun game.
I love the term that I think one of the developers said, that like the game became an unmanageable beard, like, during development, which is just something that I'm like, yeah, I get that. It's just like, it keeps on growing, because it's just like, that's what happens, is that game just keeps on growing and growing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And you're right, like, as you're playing, even though you never, until, you know, the very end at least, like, you never do anything but put things in the fireplace, there are those little kind of story hooks that come in that imply a bigger world and more things going on, and I think that keeps you invested as well. You know, it's not just burning things.
I mean, like, I don't want to get into any kind of spoiler territory, but there were even moments in that game that I'm not even going to say anything else, because I don't want to ruin it. If you haven't played this game, it's $10 until, like, the first week of January sometime. You can check at NintendoWorldReport.com for the news story on the sales on the eShop to find exactly when. It's, like, it's either the 3rd, the 4th, or the 7th that it's $5 cheaper on the eShop. And I highly recommend it. It's fantastic. So, Nick, what's your number four game?
My number four game, I would have to say, I'm going to put Sonic Racing in at number four for the Wii U.
Oh, that was one of my games that challenged the top five, but didn't make it.
Yeah, well, I was a big fan of the original Sonic All-Stars game, so I was looking forward to this one. I think overall it's a way, way better game than the first Sonic Racing.
I think it's a way better game than most Mario Kart games.
Well, yeah, that,
actually.
Yeah.
I might even go on a limb and say that it has by far the best single player I've ever played in a kart racing game.
It's very fun, and the just the general course design is like very fresh and fun, like.
And because all the levels kind of progress, where like they transform, where you know you'll be racing, like I think the kind of easy one to explain is there's a Panzer Dragoon course, and by the third lap, like a dragon attacked the course, so now you're flying in the air, and it's just crazy how they kind of alter the landscape of every track. And, I mean, it kind of reminds me of a lot of the Mario Kart 7 tracks where it's just like it's not three laps, it's just like three segments. Mm-hmm. And I always liked those tracks a lot more because they were more interesting, and that's what Sonic and Racing Transform does in, like, every game or every race.
Yeah, yeah. And I also like the change to, like, the racing mechanics and stuff. Like, it's just a bit more balanced. And in the first game, you could, you know, do, like, a trick to gain speed off jumps and stuff. They mapped the, like, a somersault move to the right stick in this one, but it's, like, the timing's more precise, so you can stuff it up a lot more easily now, and you got to pick your moments to try and get the extra boost off various jumps and stuff. Like, once you sort of get that down, I think that was, like, way more fun.
Yeah, I mean, the only kind of bummers about the game, I feel, is that, well, most of them were fixed by that patch the other week, because the multiplayer is a lot smoother now, and the single player you can actually totally finish. But other than that, I think the single player is a little too challenging to unlock everything, because it basically demands you like playing it at a hard or expert level to unlock everything, which is, I mean, I guess makes sense, but that game gets damn hard.
Yeah, I've only been playing it on medium, and like some of the... I'm currently stuck on one of the traffic evading ones with all the green cars and stuff, and like that one's just like I get so close.
I've started going back and trying to get 3 stars on everything because I want to unlock the last couple characters, and they're still out of reach.
Yeah,
it's a damn hard game, but it's very good. So yeah, Scott, what's your number 4?
My number 4 is Theater Rhythm Final Fantasy.
So is mine.
Oh, look at that. Well, then we can both talk about it. This is a game that I knew I would enjoy somewhat because I, you know, Final Fantasy obviously has a great soundtrack and I like rhythm games, but I was really surprised at how much I love this game and how much it dominated a rather sort of empty summer, I guess, as far as games go, really. I mean, it was kind of light there for a while.
Yeah. I mean, there was pretty much like there wasn't a major 3DS release in June.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and this came out at the beginning of July, so it was kind of like there was a long drought of like a month and a half without a marquee release, and then Theater Rhythm came out and answered everyone's prayers and made every other game that came out in July look like crap.
Yep. Absolutely. And maybe even everything that came out in August.
Yeah. But, I mean, Theater Rhythm is just... It's an excellent rhythm game, and it's exactly what I like out of rhythm games, because there is that kind of RPG-like progression in the Dark Note mode, but then you also have that opportunity to just play familiar songs that you love. And as proven by some people that I know, like Zach, who I don't even know if he's ever really played a Final Fantasy game before, but it's still a very enjoyable game, even if you don't like Final Fantasy music.
Oh, sure.
Don't like Final Fantasy. I guess if you didn't like the music, then you wouldn't enjoy it at all, but... Even if you're not familiar with the music, it's still very enjoyable. And if you're familiar with the music, it's on a different stratosphere. Like, mm-hmm. I would just play Dancing Mad all the time. Once I unlock that, that's pretty much I would pick up the game and be like, I feel like playing Dancing Mad, because that song's fun.
Yeah, and I was surprised at how much there was to unlock and how much there was to do.
Yeah.
And I really did love, was it the Chaos Shrine? Is that what it was called?
Yeah. Yeah, with the dark notes.
Yeah.
I called it a dark shrine or something.
Oh, okay. Well, whatever it was called, but that was great because it not only encouraged you to play songs you might not, but it basically made the game kind of fresh every time you played because it would just pick and pull from each different, like, you know, different game, to make sort of a unique overall track, which was great. And that was a lot of fun. And it was so easy. I mean, sort of like we're talking about Little Inferno, it was so easy to just get sucked into just doing one after another.
Yep. The one complaint that I have about the Dark Notes is that it pulls from such a limited, like, set list that, you know, like, what are there? There's something like 40 or 50 songs in the game, I think, and the Dark Notes only pull from, like, 20.
That's true, and that is unfortunate that it doesn't utilize
it. It would be nice if
it
included everything.
Especially the DLC and stuff. I don't think it includes any of the DLC.
Nope, not at all.
Which it makes some sense, because I think the Dark Notes you can share, you know, via Street Pass. Yeah. So they don't want to share, you know, the person.
But it made me, after the newness of the game wore off, I didn't have any interest in DLC, because I was mainly playing the Dark Notes, so what's the point?
Exactly. That was the main game mode that I went to, and you're right. I mean, it kind of, like, stopped me from buying things because I knew they wouldn't show up in there. It's like, okay, I could buy this and play it a few times for fun, get a high score maybe, but after that, yeah, what's the point? So I'd love to see a sequel where they use everything and, like, just go all out. I mean, just get a ton of songs in there. I mean, just fill up that 3DS card as much as you can.
I'd actually prefer, like, a different game series or something.
But, like, I mean, at least as far as Square Enix, what other game series could you even do? I mean, maybe Dragon Quest, but that doesn't nearly have enough memorable songs.
They could just open it up to, like, any game series they have, like Square Enix, sort of, you know. Then we could get my Chrono Trigger picks in there.
Yeah, I was just going to say, some Chrono Trigger, Chrono Cross stuff would be awesome.
I would love to see Nintendo take the theater rhythm approach to a Zelda or Mario.
Or all their stuff.
Yeah.
I mean,
Super Smash Brothers Rhythm.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Yeah, that would be great.
Someone get what is it? Did Indie Zero develop Theater Rhythm? I think they did. Get them in touch with Nintendo. Let's make this shit happen.
Neil, write an editorial for Nintendo Force and get some eyes on that, and we'll see what happens.
So, that is my number four. That is also Scott's. So, Nick, what's your number three?
My number three, I'm going to put in New Super Mario Bros. U, I think.
That's mine as well.
I haven't got as far as you. I haven't, like, finished the game yet. But so far, I've been really impressed with just the quality of the level design. I was sort of lukewarm on Super Mario Bros. Wii. Like, I found it fun and stuff. But this one just sort of really hits the level design, like, spot on, I think. It's really fun. And really impressive.
Yeah, I mean, that game, the first two worlds, I don't think are super, super interesting.
No,
but then
no.
There's this moment, and I've talked about it before, I think on last week's episode, actually.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I heard that, yeah.
Yeah, where you just get to the moment where the two worlds are there, and you have your choice, and then it just totally opens up from there, and every world from there on out is really innovative, inventive, fun, like, incredible. And that game just keeps on building and building until, you know, the Bowser's Castle area at the end is just fantastic. And then the bonus worlds are really cool. I'm still working through getting all the star coins, but man, that game is awesome.
I just finished the one of the castles where you're on like it's like a snaking block stuff that moves around the whole level. That was really fun. Like, I really enjoyed that level.
I think they've done that in other games, but even still...
They've done it in other games, but it's still fun.
Yeah, I love that stuff. I love when they kind of do crazy stuff in individual levels. Although although it's not like New Super Mario Bros. 2 is going to trump this game on my list or anything, but I need to make a little bit of a defense for that game, because I still thought that was pretty creative and inventive. For as much shit as people give that game, it was a lot of fun. And there were a lot of levels that I would play, and I'd be like, wow, I've never seen that in a Mario game before.
I was tempted to get New Super Mario Bros. 2 at one point, but I decided to skip over it to make the Wii U one, like, even more fresh. But I might go back.
Yeah. I mean, it's unfortunate, because going back after New Super Mario Bros. U is kind of like, well, this is okay, but I just had filet mignon.
Yeah, 2's fine, though. I mean, especially because we probably won't get a 2D Mario for a while. I'd say wait till, like, the middle of next year, and then just pick up 2, and you'll probably have fun with it, but...
Yeah, wait until lol.
Yeah, I'm gonna wait a while. I might even wait till I see a sale or something on it. But, back to New Super Mario Bros. U for a sec, the challenge mode and stuff was really fun as well. I've had a lot of fun with that so far. The the challenges to collect coins or avoid coins or beat the t- time trial sort of thing. Have you guys played that yet?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and even the challenge mode is really neat, and I actually played the 2-on-2 team battle in coins.
Oh, good.
The coin mode last week, that's awesome.
Is that similar to the DS multiplayer mode?
Sort of, except you actually play through, like, entire levels.
Yeah.
It's not like that one where it was just a self-contained level and you collect, like, you know, 5 stars. This, you play through a level and you try to get more coins than the other team. And then you can mess with them. Like, you can throw shells at them and, you know, sabotage them to try to take their coins from them.
Mm.
As you're playing along. So it's really cool.
It just
gets
to be pure chaos after a while.
Yeah, it's really, really fun. So, but yeah, that game almost made my list. I don't know why it didn't make my list, because I really had a lot of fun with it. I guess it just didn't, it didn't surprise me, because I just knew how good it was going to be, I guess.
Yeah.
So, but that game is excellent, of course.
I mean, well, I think what happened with me is that I was really looking forward to that game, and then I played the Boost Rush mode at the Wii U event back in September and thought that was terrible.
Right.
I still don't even really like it that much. Like, it's novel, but it's not as interesting as I think Nintendo wants it to be. So that kind of left a bad taste in my mouth. So by the time I actually played it, my expectations were a little bit lower. So then it just blew me away. So Scott, what is your number 3?
My number 3 is Resident Evil Revelations.
Oh, this is nowhere near my top
5. I was looking at the list of what came out in 2012, and this game was great. I mean, I just spent a lot of time with this game, you know, when it came out, and I just remember so many nights staying up, headphones plugged in, sitting in my dark living room while Tabby was sleeping upstairs, and just slapping on that stupid, you know, controller.
Yeah.
Pro or Plus or whatever. And
when the hell is the XL version of that going to come out? I really want that.
I'll buy it too. It's stupid as it is. And really enjoying it. Both the single player and the multiplayer was actually really good too. And I mean, I'm kind of a sucker for Resident Evil, and Resident Evil 6 is so bad. I talked about it on one episode of Connectivity, and I never talked about it again, because after that episode, I sold it on eBay for like $50 to some poor, stupid person. So yeah, so I basically lost $10. So I basically like had an expensive rental of it and played like an hour and a half and just did not like it. But Revelations is so great, because it's sort of a marriage of the new sort of Resident Evil 4 style, which is the maneuverability and a little bit more action. But it also stays true to the original Resident Evil. Well, there'll be long stretches where you don't even see any, you know, quote-unquote zombies. They're not zombies in this game. I can't remember what they call them, but sort of weird fish zombies.
Fish and, zombies.
yeah, pretty much.
Well, the funny thing is that, I forgot, like, because people were complaining about how they didn't react, but I think it was Resident Evil 6 had the same problem, right?
A little bit, yeah. They weren't as responsive. I mean, in Resident Evil 6, if you shot one in the leg, it would react as if you shot in the leg, but it didn't seem as reactive as it should, no. And that was with Revelations, too. They kind of just soaked up bullets till they died. But that, I don't know, that really wasn't ever an issue for me in Revelations. But, yeah, it was just great. It was a great-looking game for the 3DS, and the multiplayer was just a lot of fun. And I spent a lot of nights getting through that, and having a good time, so.
I mean, I enjoyed playing that game, but it just, like, I got to a point in the story mode where it was, like, a really annoying boss, and I beat it, and I was just kind of like, I don't really want to play this anymore. Like, I think the multiplayer mode is really cool. It's similar to Mercenaries, but, like, more novel in a way, because it's, you know, I guess it ends. That's the thing with Mercenaries, is that, like, basically the fail state in that always happens, whereas in raid mode, like, there is an ending.
Right.
And you feel victorious at the end.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think the multiplayer mode's really cool, and I like the production values of the single player, but the fact that it jumps around between a bunch of characters that I don't give a shit about, like, the story just kind of lost me to the point where I didn't even really know what was going on. And I wish they just left me in the damn boat for the entire game.
That's true. It does jump around a bit much. I think, I guess, in an effort to try to let you play through different environments without having one single character traveling through all these different environments. But you're right. I mean, it does jump around, and there are some uninteresting characters. But I don't know. So something about it, it was really great, and I think if you tried Resident Evil 6 and didn't like it, as you should if you're a human being with eyes and ears, and you didn't play Revelations, you totally should go back and play it.
Yeah. All right, so Nick, what's your number two?
Number two, I'm going to say Nintendo Land.
That is a fine, fine game. Now, are you enjoying the single player a lot?
I've played some games in the single player, but I've put way more time into it as a multiplayer game, because I've got like friends and that they've come around and stuff, and I've basically played like the Mario Chase and the Luigi's Mansion and all that stuff, and it's been pretty fun. I've almost finished the Metroid games. Yeah, I finally
coaxed a friend into playing through a bunch of the Metroid levels with me, and holy crap, that game's so much fun. You just need to get the right people to play
it.
It's a lot more. I mean, they even say it in the intro thing to that. Like, this is the most hardcore game in Nintendo Land.
Yeah, you really do need to find, like, just one friend or, like, two friends or whatever that can just go through it with you that are already acquainted with, like, video games and stuff.
The Kraid boss fight is so cool.
It is really cool, yeah. And the Ridley one was sort of easy in comparison. Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
But it's pretty fun.
Yeah, because that's, I think at this point, in total, it is by far my most played Wii game. I think I'm closing in on like 20 hours or something in that game, with the majority of it being multiplayer. And I think as a multiplayer experience, that game is tops. And I still am looking forward to seeing how much I'm playing that game in like 6 months, because I think that'll prove the true value of Nintendo Land.
Yeah, my friend, I had like 500 coins for that thing in Nintendo Land, and we just...
Yeah, I think you max out at 500. I need to go and play some fucking pachinko.
Yeah, it maxes out at 500, and we just wasted, like, all 500 within, like, 10 minutes yesterday.
Yeah.
Like, you can just sort of, like, spray, like, a whole bunch of coins across the screen and just win, so that's all I do.
Yeah, that's kind of what I do. Yeah. I mean, if you're going to play the game a lot, then, I mean, the coins don't really mean anything. Just blow them. Just finish it off. Just as long as you don't hit the skulls that reset everything.
It was really cool. Luigi's Mansion having two extra levels as well was a pretty good surprise.
Yeah. I also love the kind of zeitgeist mystery about, like, do Animal Crossing and Mario Chase also have unlockable levels too? But it's looking like they don't at all.
I wish they did, that they don't, yeah.
Same here.
Especially Mario Chase. I think it would, like, yeah.
Yeah, I do love how the levels scale, though, because I was playing with just three people, and seeing how the, like, and all three of those competitive multiplayer games, how the levels shrink, and it's like you don't even really notice it, unless you almost, like, look at them at the same time, because it's very subtle how they make them bigger and smaller.
Yeah, I almost finished the Captain Falcons game as well. I missed the very last boost pad, and I saw the door in front of me coming down, and my nose hit it as the door slammed shut. And I was like, no.
All right, so Scott, what's your number two?
My number two is Zombie U.
Wow, it's not number one. I'm curious, what the hell is number one?
Mm-hmm. I won't spoil number one. But
yeah, don't spoil it yet. I'm just going to be curious.
I was expecting that to be number one.
Yeah.
Zombie U should be my number one, and if
Savvy Trainset is
there, you have it. And in any other year, it would have been my number one, but there's just one other game that came out that blew me away. But Zombie U is just such a wonderful game. I mean, I don't know what else I can say about it that I haven't said, like, week in and week out for the past month now. But I love this game, and all I can say is if you are at all a fan of being scared in your video games, then this is a game you have to play. It's got to be the most frightening game I've played.
A friend of mine... Oh, sorry for cutting you off.
No, Neil, it's fine. Oh, now that you're with Nintendo Force, it's just the Neil show, so go ahead.
I was just going to say, I had a friend lives in Germany, but he's home for the holidays, and he had never played a Wii U before, so... I, like, showed him the system, showed him Miiverse, and was just like, here, try this game out, and put the controller in his hands.
Oh, God.
And watched him play Zombie U and go from just, like, what the hell is going on? What the hell is going on? To, like, learning it and really, really enjoying it. Like, he put, like, an hour and a half into it. I think he was on his way back from the shopping market and then he died right then, and then we ended up going and we played some multiplayer Nintendo Land. But it was just, it to me, it showed off even more of the brilliance of that game, of just how it kind of teaches you, almost by, like, teaching you by failure. Like, you die, this is what happens, and you're like, oh, I lost all my shit. Crap. I just thought it was really cool seeing it from someone else's perspective in that way, because, I mean, all of us, we've kind of been following it since it was announced.
Right. Yeah, no, I totally agree. And, I mean, even following it, there's still some surprises that you don't expect. But, yeah, to see it through fresh eyes, like, not knowing at all what's going to happen and what really sets it apart from other games, that's got to be kind of fun and unique. But, yeah, just as far as tense and scary games go, I don't think you're going to find anything better than this. Certainly, obviously, not on the Wii U, probably not on any Nintendo platform. And I'd say it's been a while since a really scary game came out on any platform.
Dead Space?
Dead Space, and then there's like, what's that? That game came out on PC, on Steam.
Amnesia.
Yeah, Amnesia is fairly good too, but I think this really is just like the mea culpa of scary games.
Scott, have you played any of the multiplayer in Zombie U yet?
I haven't.
It's really cool.
Yeah, it is really cool. My friend brought it around and showed me for like 40 minutes or so. It's like pretty fun.
It's like one person's playing as like a real-time, it's like a real-time strategy game, and the other person's playing a first-person shooter.
Dropping in like different enemies for them to try and kill, and you have like a limited amount of resources that slowly open up as you sort of do more stuff in the multiplayer, I guess, in that session.
I think the one thing that I would love to see, and I don't want to speak too soon, but I'm pretty sure we're going to see a Zombie U sequel. Hopefully that's not called Zombie U 2. but if they had the multiplayer where it was like one person on the gamepad and three people playing the first-person shooter, or maybe even four and having it be split-screen or something, like that would be incredible. Because that's the one thing, is that it does seem like it's very much like one versus one, and okay, there's like a capture the flag mode and everything, but it's like, it's very much like you're just going against head to head, where it's like kind of, if you threw a few more people into the fray, it would make it where like that person would have to juggle their resources more and be smarter about it, as opposed to just kind of like putting every zombie down whenever they can right in front of that person or as close to.
Hey, Neil, did you play the multiplayer with the Wii Remote, or did you use like a classic controller or something?
I used a pro controller.
Okay. The Wii Remote controls on that are really, really wonky. I don't know if that was sort of on purpose or it's really bad.
Yeah, I haven't.
Like, you can sort of adjust to it.
I know people always rave about the first-person shooter controls on the Wii, but I was never really a huge fan. In Metroid Prime, I think they work really well, but in most first-person shooters, I'm so accustomed to dual sticks that it's kind of weird.
I think like this is a game full of ideas that I don't know if they just ran out of time since it was a launch game or
definitely.
What,
they definitely ran out of time.
There's a lot of great ideas that could easily be expanded upon in a sequel, and I think it's sold well enough that we'll see a sequel.
Yeah.
And you're right, it can't unfortunately be called Zombie U 2. That's a problem a lot of Wii U games are going to quickly run into, is that, well, we can't use U 2.
It should be
so
called
Zombies. Zombies U, kind of like Alien to Aliens. Yeah, that would be pretty cool. but yeah, something like that. I mean, it expanded, you know, even bigger single player, online multiplayer, maybe a cooperative mode. I mean, just, there's a few things.
They basically put out this game that is this fantastic, like, almost bare bones version of what this game can be. And if they just expand on that and like give a new story with, you know, some new mechanics and everything, like, oh man, and this is coming from the person who might not ever finish the first one, and that really, really excites me.
Yeah. So, yeah, absolutely number two, so.
Alright, so my number two is an eShop game, which you guys can probably all guess, as I have not really hidden the fact how much I love this game, but it's Mutant Muds. Came out back in January, one of the first games of this year that I played, and still, like, one of my favorites. I love playing this game, and it's very deliberate that it trumps New Super Mario Bros. U, because with New Super Mario Bros. U, like, I beat it, I'm done. With Mutant Muds, like, I've replayed that game 2.5 times at this point. I love it. I think it's fantastic. I can't wait for the Wii U version of it. And it's just, like, a game I can't get enough of. And I can't wait for Mutant Muds 2, and as long as it keeps that kind of, like, Gargoyle's Quest meets Wario Land Virtual Boy gameplay, like, I'm in. I love both of those games, and I love this game. That's I don't even really have anything else to say about it.
I need to put more time into this game. I downloaded it. I downloaded it not too long ago, and I don't know. It's just kind of slow for me, but I know
it is very slow. But for me, like that, it's like that's how it works. Like sure. I wish it moved a little bit faster, but that's probably my only nitpick about it. Other than the fact that it gets hard, which is more just like it is a hard game. And you need to get good at it in order to win it.
Yeah, see, that's where I want to get to is like the hard stuff. Cause right now it's just kind of slow and just sort of like not entirely interesting, I guess. But I know that changes as you play and things, you know, the gameplay changes a bit. So
yeah, and even the added free DLC, like those levels are fantastic. But yeah, that's my number two. So Nick, what's your number one?
Okay, I saved this one to number one because it's probably the most lengthy game on the list, and it's The Last Story.
I still have not played this game. I've owned it since the day it came out in North America.
I played it back in February, I think.
Yeah, that's when it came out in Europe.
Yeah.
Or and your PAL region.
Yes. Well, I think I like the game a lot. I didn't buy Xenoblade because the length of it sort of scared me away because I knew I would just sort of get like 15 hours in, just drop it probably.
That sounds oddly familiar.
Yeah. I've still got like Blue Dragon and stuff on the 360, so like sort of around that same mark, you know, like I've just got all these RPGs that I don't finish. But The Last Story, I got all the way through it pretty much and, the pacing's really good and you can just sort of keep pushing forward. Nothing really gets in your way. You can just sort of keep going through and everything sort of happens at a pretty good pace. I think, you know, it's around 20 to 25 hours long. So, it stayed interesting the whole time. The graphics are really cool and, I enjoyed the battle system quite a bit because it was a bit different and, you can sort of run up walls and duck behind cover and stuff like that. So it's pretty fun.
Yeah, I've actually been meaning to kind of dive into this game as we do our site-wide end-of-the-year stuff, just at least be able to play it. But I'll probably be doing that in the next week or so. But, I was more intrigued in this game than Xenoblade when both of those games were being discussed because the idea of that kind of, like, 20-hour RPG experience with a driving story and some interesting battle mechanics seemed more appealing to me than Xenoblade, you know, the 90-plus hour gargantuan quest that is. And while I sincerely adore the 15, 20 hours that I put into Xenoblade, and I'll optimistically say that I'll go back and play more of that, because I found that game was surprisingly easy to just jump back into. But, I mean, with both of those games, they both seem like they're fantastic. And I can't wait to dive into, well, obviously I can wait to dive into Last Story, considering it has been 4 months at this point.
It's been long enough already.
I'm excited to dive into it whenever I get the chance. Scott, do you have any interest in this game?
Yes. I mean, I love RPGs, so it'll be something I get to at some point.
I think it's like $20 at this point.
Yeah, I know it's been on sale and gotten cheaper, so I want to pick it up before it obviously just becomes ultra rare, so. I'll probably do that, and then at some point when there's a lull, I'll just play it on the Wii U.
Yeah, that's my plan. Yeah. We're hitting a lull. So.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's true. I guess when we hit a lull is right now, so.
Yeah. So what's your number one, Scott?
Well, relatedly, my number one is Xenoblade Chronicles.
That's what I figured.
I know. See, this one's all like, when I do the actual NWR voting, like this won't be my number one.
Yeah, for anyone who is curious, and we'll highlight this when we do our favorite 10 games of 2012, which is what we do because we're not the major site where everyone plays everything, so doing a definitive top 10 list seems wrong. But Xenoblade does not count for this year. because last year when we did it, we kind of made the executive decision that Xenoblade wasn't going to come to North America, and we were happily proven wrong. But Xenoblade made our top 10 list last year, so it is therefore not allowed to be in it this year, but we will probably have some kind of special mention, because that game's fucking awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. So it can't officially be in my list for NWR, but for my personal list, I mean, it came out in America this year, I played it this year, so for me, it has to be number one. As great as Zombie U is, to me, Xenoblade Chronicles, like, entirely revives a genre of game. Something that's just been so stagnant. I mean, the last story does sound great, and I'm excited to play it, but apart from that, I mean, it's hard to really think of a great sort of Japanese role-playing game.
That's not on the DS.
Right, yeah, sure, because there are some good DS ones, too.
And I would also say that, like, on DS and, I guess, PSP and probably Vita and 3DS eventually, you have a lot of those RPGs that kind of harken back to, like, the Super Nintendo RPGs that everyone loves.
Right.
Like, Radiant Historia, which I think is one of, like, the best games in the past 10 years, like, that's basically, like, a Super Nintendo game that never happened. Whereas Xenoblade is an RPG that is wholly, I mean, maybe not completely wholly new, but it's super, super refined, and it is the future of RPGs.
Yeah, totally. And yeah, and I mean, I absolutely agree with that. I mean, that's how I feel about it. I really do think it's an extension and a growth of the genre. And just fabulous. I mean, throughout the combat really steals the show, which is great because that's what you do a whole lot of in this game.
Yeah. I really enjoyed playing that game.
Yeah. It's great. The music is absolutely wonderful.
Oh man.
I've listened to the soundtrack, yeah. That's pretty nice.
It's so good. It's
that
so
was
good.
Ultimately what sold me on the game was, I think might have been like some kind of live radio trivia thing on some sort of telethon, maybe. I know Greg Leahy was there, and they played the Xenoblade music, and I didn't know what it was from. And then I found out it was from Xenoblade, and I was like, well, shit, I do need to get this game.
Yeah. I mean, the fact that you can spend, like, I mean, if you choose to do all the side quests, you could spend, like, 2 to 3 hours straight in one zone doing, you know, doing the side quests, and you'll hear the same music over and over. It's the same track repeating. It never gets old. It's so good. I can't think of any time where I was, like, felt grated at all by, like, the music, you know, like I found it just, like, too much, and I wanted to switch to something else or turn it down. You know, it was always so, so great.
Yeah.
And the game, it's just so polished, and to just see what they did with being on such limited hardware. I mean, it's kind of, I don't know if I would say inspiring, but it's, I don't know. I think they worked well with the limitations that were in place.
You know what's going to be really cool? When Monolith makes an RPG for Wii U, because that's happening
HD,
as we speak.
HD.
I know.
In Japan, a team at Monolith Soft is making an RPG for Wii U.
I know. I'm so excited. And I will say, too, one great thing about Xenoblade Chronicles is the story is actually, like, easy to follow and digest. I mean, it gets crazy at the end. I mean, there's certain twists and turns.
Yeah, I've heard about that.
But it's not, like, over your head. It's not super, I don't know, like, complicated or convoluted or, like trying to be philosophical. Like, it's very easy to follow and understand what's going on.
I mean, I don't really know. I've only heard how it gets crazy, not how it gets crazy. But at least where I am in the game, it's very much, they do a great job. I still think that, like, the 3-4 hours, like, the intro to that game is probably one of, like, I think that trumps a little Inferno for experience of the year, in all honesty. Like, I think that intro is so fucking well done. But it just does a very good job of kind of setting the stakes for the game. And it's almost like whatever weird, like, you know, like, lore and mythical bullshit that's surrounding, like, that game, how, like, you know, you're on two guys that are locked in battle, and now you're on, like, the Bionis leg. And, like, all that kind of weird stuff. Like, it doesn't matter, because they have that very basic story that's guiding you through. And there, it seems like there is a lot of shit on the periphery that, if you really wanted to get into that lore and, you know, read everything in the game, there's stuff to discover. But to have motivation to go through the game, they do a good job of just kind of being like, this dude is kidnapped. Go save him. It's not like, we need to go get the medallion so that way we can do this and save the bear.
Right.
Like, it's very much like, go here, do that, as opposed to, like, loosely do things. And they give you constant motivation, and the music accentuates that, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. No, I absolutely agree. Yeah, it's just a very well-made, thorough game throughout, and yeah. I'm very, very happy it came to America. So
there will definitely come a time where I go back to that game because, partially it was because my Wii died that my playthrough was cut short.
Yeah.
But I was kind of shocked that, like, it was, like, 2 or 3 months later that I went back and played it, and they have, like, the previously on thing that you can bring up, and mm-hmm. the combat is really, really easy to get back into, which...
Oh, yeah.
I know, like, I think, like, Chrono Cross is one game that I picked up a save midway through, and I was just like, ho, this ain't fucking happening.
Right.
I'm like, yeah, I need to remember what these elements mean.
Yep, totally. Yeah, it's very good in that way, and it does a lot of things to sort of streamline the RPG experience, you know, with the fact that you can easily just fast-forward the clock to change the time of day, so you can do different quests that only you can do at night or a day, or, you know, there's certain weather patterns, you can fast-forward days to do that, you can... easily at any point fast travel from any landmark to another landmark, which is great. And yeah, it's such a good game. I really can't say enough about it.
All right. So let's conclude this segment. I don't think we're doing that Nintendo year for 2012.
Just
putting a word out there. I don't think that's going down today, guys. sorry to disappoint.
Yeah. We'll save that for next week.
But to close this out, my number one is Kid Icarus Uprising.
Which
I don't really think is that much surprise to anyone. Despite the fact that I haven't really played... Well, the last time I played this game was New York Comic Con, where I played some multiplayer. And that was a game that I didn't even have my CirclePad Pro, because I have the XL now. But I love that game. Like, the multiplayer is fantastic. I think the single player is kind of crazy and bonkers and ridiculous. Although I do have to say that some of the later levels, upon replay, like, once the, like... and now we're fighting aliens wears off, like, that some of the later stuff does drag on a bit, but just that experience from start to finish, like, you think it's going to end, and then it doesn't, and then it doesn't, and you think it's going to end, and, oh, no, you still have another couple levels left. And I love that, because it's not like I was ever really bored during that. I was just kind of blown away that the game kept on going. And the motivation that there is to replay to get these different weapons that then you can use in multiplayer, and multiplayer is so much fun. By far, this is the game that I put the most time in on my 3DS. I think I'm at 50 or 60 hours at this point. The next closest is, like, Super Mario 3D Land with, like, 25, I think. I think, like, it's crazy. I love this game. It's so good.
Yeah, I don't know. You raved about this game, and I tried to so desperately get into it, and it just never, ever grabbed me the way it did for you.
I mean, the controls are weird, but for me, it's like, even playing this with the wrong hand is still worth it to me. Just, I mean, to see what there is. Even in multiplayer now, I can play it right-handed, and it's still extremely enjoyable. I guess at this point, I kind of just want to see, like, some of the lessons that Sakurai might have learned with Kid Icarus Uprising in a new Smash Brothers. Because I think at least the multiplayer kind of takes that idea of Smash Brothers and makes it a behind-the-back third-person, like, shooter almost. And I'd kind of like to see, maybe that will inform the next Smash Brothers game in interesting ways, which I hope to see.
So, yeah, I guess we can go over some of our non-Tendo games and, just honorable mentions, anything like that.
Yeah, that we will do a full-fledged That Nintendo Year for 2012. Probably next week, but now we'll just kind of go over some other major games that we enjoyed, whether they be Nintendo systems or not. So Nick, do you have any non-Tendo games that really caught your fancy this year?
Non-Nintendo games. I wasn't actually expecting that. I haven't really thought about it.
Sorry to put you on the spot. We can come back to you.
That's okay. I guess I played Halo 4, Uncharted 2, yeah, that's all I can think of right now. I've played some other downloadable games. I played Knights on the Xbox Live Arcade.
How was that? I was just kind of curious.
Yeah,
it's
pretty
that,
good.
But I've never really played that game before.
It's
always been curious.
It's pretty fun. Like, once you sort of get used to the game and how it works and everything. One of the complaints I had earlier on when I first started playing it was that the field of vision is narrow. Sometimes it's at, like, you don't really know what's coming next, and it's sort of annoying. But once I got over that, it's It's pretty nice, pretty fun. And they patched the game controls like a couple of months ago, so it's closer to how it would control on the Sega Saturn. Because when it first came out, it was a bit... people were complaining that you couldn't do like a perfect circle. It was a bit more, you know, square-shaped.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. So, Scott, what non-Tendo games did you have?
Well, I had two that would have been on my list before I realized we weren't doing non-Tendo games, so I took them off. Diablo 3 gets an honorable mention. It's weird how quickly that game kind of just, like, I lost all interest in it. it's sort of like how with Revelations, I guess, where you just hit that point where you're like, I guess I'm done with this now.
Yeah, and it's not like I didn't enjoy it. Like, I really enjoyed Revelations. It's just that I didn't want to play it anymore.
Right, absolutely. But Diablo 3 was this, like, great month-long experience. I played a lot with Nate. Our managing editor here at Nintendo World Report, we played a ton together. And then, I mean, I just, so many nights where I was just up way later than I should have been, just constantly playing, thinking, just get through one more room, you know, get one, right, one more loot drop, you'll probably get something good. Just keep going a little bit more. And, I mean, to be fair, I did play through the game technically like 2.5 times, because you play through once and then you unlock the next difficulty, you play through on that, and then you unlock the next difficulty, and then after that you know, then there's the absolute hardest difficulty. So I did play through it 2.5 times, so it's not like I didn't get my money's worth, but it was just sort of that third difficulty tier, things just started to get really difficult to the point where I was having a hard time doing it by myself. So then I just hit a wall and just stopped, but I think it's something I'll go back to eventually, but just totally great game. I mean, just refines what the Diablo series has done all along, and really, really great. A lot of fun, especially if you can play with some friends. So, the other game I just recently started playing, which I talked about last week, but XCOM, yeah, Enemy Unknown. I mean, this is just my cup of tea. I love strategy games, turn-based strategy games, so I'm thoroughly impressed with this game. I probably put like 15 hours in it in the past like week and a half, 2 weeks, whatever, since I downloaded it. I've just been trying to play it as much as I can, so very, very, very good.
So, my games that I have, I'll divide this into two categories. Vita and downloadable titles, because there weren't really anything else that kind of caught my fancy. I played games on PS3 and 360, that, like retail games, but there's just nothing that really grabbed me too much. But on downloadable platforms, I really, really loved NFL Blitz. I played it a lot with my friends. I thought the multiplayer in that game was great, and there's just really, really well done strategy in that game. And, I mean, from someone who wasn't really ever that experienced with the original, like, it seems like it's similar but different, so it turned off a lot of the people that like the original. But yeah, that game is really, really cool. I'm also a huge fan of the game Awesomenauts, which I'm kind of surprised that more people don't play. If you're not familiar with the MOBAs, the multiplayer online battle arenas, like your League of Legends and your Dotas and stuff like that, this is a 2D side-scrolling version of that, and it's fucking incredible. It's on XBLA and PSN. And there's also a Steam version that I should probably play more of because they have more characters because they don't have to, you know, pay $40,000 for the update or whatever. But I've been playing a ton of, like, I play with friends a lot where, well, because it's 3-on-3, so you can play with, you know, three people on one system and go online or just play the computer. And we'll usually play the computer a couple times, and once we're kicking the crap out of them, then we'll go online and usually get our asses kicked. But it just, it's like all the characters play differently, but there's different ways you can play each character, and it's just really well balanced. They've had a couple balancing patches since it came out that just make it even better, and it's just such a fun game, and I wish that there were more 2D MOBAs like that. And for anyone who's curious, it's developed by Ronimo Games. They made Sword and Soldiers, which was a WiiWare game. They're also the people who made the original prototype for Da Blob. And then they sold it to THQ and, you know, probably made a development studio based off of that money that they made off to THQ. That then THQ promptly lost and closed the team that developed both the Blob 1 and 2, and now they're in administration.
That's neither here nor there. Merry Christmas, everybody.
I also really like Tony Hawk's Pro Skater HD, although if you were to force me to write a critical review of that game, I'd probably tear it to shreds. But I just love Tony Hawk games, and warts and all, I put so much time into that game.
I would have preferred them on that to just to put out like a, you know, just a cleaned up version of one of the old games instead of sort of trying to make it new again.
Yeah. Like, I mean, yeah, if they just made Tony Hawk 3 again, I would not complain. Because I actually, when I was playing Tony Hawk HD, and I really enjoyed it, but I went back and played Tony Hawk 3 and was just like, wow, this is way better. What the hell? Like, I mean, the new game's cool and all, and I'm glad it exists, but, like, couldn't they have just made this game again? And then my last game is far and away, I think, the best Vita game out there, by far, and that is Mutant Blobs Attack Tales from Space. It's also on Steam. It's by Drinkbox Studio, who they're also making Guacamelee, which I don't know when it's coming out. I think soon, but it's a, I think it's coming to PS3 and Vita and maybe Steam later. It's a Sony PubFund game, so probably not. But Guacamelee is this awesome 2D, like it's a Metroid clone, but you're a luchador. I played a demo at New York Comic Con in which they even have a Chozo statue that you fight early on.
Really?
Yeah. Like, they have, like, the little, like, Metroid chime comes on, too. Like, I'm glad they had, Sony had headphones at their booth for that game while I was playing that, the Unloved demo stand that was there. But the game that these guys actually had that came out in 2012, Tales from Space, Mutant Blobs Attack, is kind of like, I guess kind of the best way to say it is that it's like 2D Katamari. Because you're basically, you know, it's a side-scrolling game where you play as a blob, but you, you know, eat food and stuff and solve puzzles, and you grow bigger and bigger, and then naturally the last level you eat the universe. But it's just really, really awesome, and I can't recommend that game enough. So that's my non-Tendo stuff for 2012.
I don't know, best Vita game, though, is kind of a stretch in the ear when you get Persona 4 ported to the Vita.
See, I mean, like, I haven't played Persona 4 Golden, so maybe, but it's like, that doesn't appeal to me as much, because for me, like, Mutant Blobs Attack was something that I hadn't really played before, whereas I've played Persona 3.
And I guess Persona 4 is so much better.
And I've heard Persona 4 is so much better, but it's like, I'm looking at the game and I'm like, $40, I don't know. Like, I got Persona 3 for $15 on PS2, and then I got it for $5 on Vita. I think I'll just play Persona 3 again and wait for that shit to get cheaper.
I guess so. You should at some point play Persona 4, though.
Oh, no, I want to. It's just that I'm not $40 interested in that game, especially when Sony's making every game free on the Vita on PlayStation Plus, pretty much.
That's true, yeah. It probably will be free very soon.
I get to play Retro City Rampage for free. I'm excited about that because I was considering getting that game. And then, like, I just, oh, it's free this week? Sweet! So yeah.
Well, there you go.
Yep.
So yeah, I guess we'll be back next week with our that Nintendo year for 2012, and whoever joins us then, probably Zach and whoever else, will give us their top five games of the year. So.
So Nick, you will probably not be joining us next week. Do you have any parting thoughts for 2012, or hopes and dreams for 2013 that you would like to share with us and our audience?
Hopes and dreams. I really want to play BitTrip Runner 2. That is my next game I'm going to get on the eShop, most likely, when it comes out.
Let me tell you, sir, I've been playing the Steam beta. It is fantastic.
It's so good.
Yeah,
really,
I heard
is.
You guys talk about it last week, I think. But, I really love the first game, so really need to get that game.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm very excited. I mean, I can't wait to play that game on my Wii U with the TV off.
Mm-hmm.
If you know what I mean.
Well, I thought I did, but now I don't know what you mean. So, I guess that's it.
Yeah.
Yep.
See you guys next week.
All right.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Thanks.
And that will do it for episode 66 of Connectivity. As always, you can send us listener mail to connectivity@nintendoworldreport.com. If you get a chance to rate and review us on iTunes, that would be awesome. And you should follow us on Twitter. Go to nintendoworldreport.com, look for the Twitter sidebar on the right side, and you'll find all of our usernames there. Thanks everyone for making 2012 a great year for the podcast, and we'll see you guys in 2013.
And be sure to stick around now for our Doctor Who bonus segment.
Danger. Danger.
What's wrong?
There is danger here. An intelligence. An intelligence beyond anything else in this time and place.
Dr. Simeon, sir. There's someone demanding to see you.
No callers, not in here, not ever. Did he leave his name?
Sir, it's Sherlock Holmes.
Oh, there. Night office. Big, globey thing. Now, shut up. Don't tell me. I see from your collar stud you have an apple tree and a wife with a limp. Am I right?
No.
You have a wife?
No.
Bit of a tree, bit of a wife. Some apples. Come on, work with me here.
I enjoy the Strand magazine as much as the next man, but I'm perfectly aware that Sherlock Holmes is a fictional character. Get out!
Do you want a goldfish named Colin?
No.
Thought not. Now, oh, I see this is one of your business cards. It says so on the front.
Who are you? And what are you doing here?
This.
Wakey, wakey!
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the special bonus segment of Connectivity. I am Scott Thompson. Today, I'm joined by David Eagolf.
Hello.
And special guest, Amanda Albert.
Hello.
You've probably heard her mentioned on the podcast a few times, girlfriend of Mike Sklenz. He was going to be here to talk Doctor Who with us, and then he was going out of town. So he offered Amanda, who apparently knows a million times more than Mike Sklenz does about Doctor Who anyway. So I think we've gotten an upgrade.
Yeah, he tried to make it seem like he was being nice to me. And then I realized, oh, this just coincides with the time you're going away. This wasn't you being nice. It's just convenient.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, we're going to talk about the recent Doctor Who Christmas special, The Snowmen. We'll talk about that episode and I guess a little bit of our predictions for where it leaves off and what it means for the rest of this season, which I think starts back up in April, if I'm not mistaken, which is way too long.
Seriously.
I must agree.
But let's just start with just general impressions. What did you guys think about the episode? Amanda, you can start.
No pressure. I really, really liked it. Anytime they make references to classic Doctor Who makes me happy, and there was a good amount of them in this. Are we allowed to talk about spoilers? I'm assuming.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Go all out.
Oh, okay. So I love that he screws himself over in the past by showing them the map of the underground so that they can destroy it later. It's just
right.
Perfect.
Right. Well, actually, Amanda, talk about a little bit of the references to the older stuff too for people who might not know, like probably myself.
Patrick Troughton, the second Doctor, had a recurring villain for a little bit that was the Great Intelligence, which
okay.
The Great Intelligence Institute, when he sees the card in the show, he says, oh, it rings a bell, and he's looking at the card.
Yeah.
And, I think it'll, if we want to get into a little bit of conspiracy theories with it, I mean, I think that, Oswin is going to tie into it because in the classic series, the Great Intelligence ended up being a collective intelligence that would reside in bodies, and it could move around.
Oh, okay.
So it's interesting that this Oswin has showed up twice, and it looks like she's going to show up for at least a third time. I don't know. Maybe they mentioned genius in the Asylum of the Daleks episode, and that you need a great intelligence. Maybe it's not really her. Maybe it's this great intelligence in her. Who knows? But I like that, and it felt really fun. It was very Tim Burton-y with them going up the steps to the TARDIS.
Yeah, I'll say, like, I felt this episode, especially compared to the rest of this season specifically, it was very whimsical, and I think that's been kind of missing. Like, the first four or five, I think it was five episodes of the season, it was very, like, quick-moving, and there was a lot going on, and it was, for the most part, kind of dark. I mean, there's always humor, but it didn't feel very lighthearted, and this episode did to me, which is great, because I think that's a big part of Doctor Who.
Yeah, there's going to be the fun.
Yeah. David, what did you think about it?
I really did quite enjoy the episode. I was never a big Who fan for the old series. I didn't start watching until after the reboot and never got around to watching the old stuff. However, I really did enjoy the special. It kind of felt right that the Doctor was done. You know, he spent time with Amy and Rory, and after that whole ordeal, you know, he wanted to be done with it. And then when Clara Osmond was answering the questions, and she said pond, you could tell that, well, you know, the way that they set the scene up, the Doctor, he realized that, you know, maybe there's more to it. And I just thought that it was scripted really well, and I just really thoroughly enjoyed it.
That was an interesting scene too, because it's kind of like establishing the pawns as sort of this Doctor's rose in a way. Like, I got a lot of like feeling of David Tennant and how he always, you know, longed for Rose, no matter who his companion was. Like, any like mention of her, like allusion to her, like always affected him. And it seems like that's going to be the same with this Doctor and the pawns.
Hopefully Clara won't be Martha, though.
Yeah, hopefully not. Although I like Martha, but
I do.
She just—I feel bad for her mostly. She gets the short end of the stick.
Clara just doesn't strike me as the type to make pie faces at the Doctor.
Right. Every time he like thinks of Rose or something.
Right. It seems like Clara will put him in his place.
Well, and it seems like he'll be happy to be put in his place. Like, I was surprised at how quickly this episode, like, just sort of established that there was going to be some kind of possible, like, romantic, like, inclinations between the two of them. You know, who knows what that will ever manifest as. But just the fact that, like, they're kissing in the episode, and he's joking that, like...
He kisses every companion.
Well, I guess that's true at some point. But, I mean, this was, like, right out of the gate.
Except for Mickey. Like,
well, yeah, that's true. Never Mickey.
But still, Rory.
Yeah, sure, that's true.
Pretty sure he kissed Jack Harkness, too, didn't he?
Yes, he did.
He did. I guess that's true. Yeah, maybe she's not so special after all. But even just, like, they're sort of, like, badgering, and, like, when she made him go up the ladder first, and then, you know, she was commenting about how she was, you know, would look up and not look forward and was, like, checking him out and stuff. It was kind of surprising to see. But totally fine. I was happy with it. I think she's a great character.
I just wonder if River is going to be upset or not. Or do they have an open marriage?
And see, I was wondering that too. Like, that has to come up at some point, right? She'll show up in some episode and see their relationship and have some kind of remark for it. And maybe they do. I don't know. I wonder how much River's going to show up now that the pawns are gone anyway.
Well, if River does show up, will it be before or after she's married to the Doctor?
Mm.
Huh? That's true. Yeah, I guess I could get around it that way. Yeah, you never know with those two. So one part I have to talk about was the sort of Sherlock crossover, which, I mean, I just absolutely loved. David, do you watch Sherlock?
Not the series.
Okay, well, you really need to watch Sherlock. And once you start watching it, you, like everyone else on the planet, will think, why can't Sherlock and Doctor Who be the same show? Like, why can't these two characters be together in some capacity? And I think this is just such a funny way of Stephen Moffat kind of acknowledging fans wanting that, and then just totally kind of showing that he'll never do that. But I thought it was great. Just the way, I mean, when he busts into Sherlock Holmes, like, it plays the music from Sherlock, the show. And, like, just all the deductions he's trying to make, just completely wrong. And it was just so, so funny. I think I'm going to steal some audio from that part, and I'm going to intro this segment with it, because it was just so
well done. The worst deductions ever.
Like when he asked the one guy if he has a fish named Colin, and he says no. He says, I thought not. just so good.
Yeah.
So that really took me by surprise, but I loved that entire scene.
I love also how Stephen Moffat kind of slips it in there that, oh, it's very suspicious how Madame Vostra and her companions, just so suspicious how close they are, and the Strand is basing these stories on them.
Yeah, that was pretty funny. The whole story would actually be based off those two, which is pretty good. Did we know they were married before?
No.
I didn't think so.
It was hinted at that they were together.
Yeah.
But not that they were married.
Yeah, it was pretty cool to see them show up again, too. And then same with Strax, who I thought was really funny in this episode.
Oh, I love him. I want him to be the new companion.
That would be great. I thought the three of them worked really well. I didn't expect them to be in this. But I thought they did a really good job supporting the Doctor and trying to get him to be his old self.
I felt like they were his sober friends.
Yeah, basically, yeah. And they're trying to, like, have an intervention with him.
Yeah.
To bring him back from the ledge.
Yeah, they're going to make a banner and confront him.
I like, too, that, I guess, going back to some of the David Tennant stuff, that we are establishing kind of, like, a crew of characters who can kind of come in and out from episode to episode or season to season.
Yeah.
I feel like that's something that's been missing with the Matt Smith Doctor. I mean, obviously through the David Tennant stuff leading up to the David Tennant, his final season's, you know, finale, where they all come together to help him. But I thought it was kind of cool that to see these characters return, more than just like River, who's been really the only one to return for the most part.
Yeah, really, because it almost sometimes feels like they're two different shows. So it's like cool to see Strax come in because he was, you know, involved with Ten. So it's like, oh yeah, that shit did happen.
Right. Right, and to kind of tie that all together. So yeah, I enjoyed that quite a bit. I was happy with them and thought they were handled very well. What did you guys think about the actual villains in this episode? Because so far we've talked about how great some of the auxiliary stuff was. What did you think about... Oh god, I can't even think of his name.
Was it Dr. Simeon?
Yeah, you're right, yeah, Dr. Simeon. Like, what did you think about him and the plot with the snowmen and everything?
I mean... It suited the purpose. It jump started this thing with Claire coming back in. It wasn't bad, but you know, it's like it's exactly what you would think a Doctor Who villain would be if you were gonna like do a parody of Doctor Who.
Yeah.
Snowmen to destroy the world.
Right. The snowmen were pretty creepy though, with the huge like jagged teeth and stuff. I thought they were kind of frightening for, you know, what is ostensibly a children's show.
Yeah, I thought it looked great, and I always enjoy that twist where Moffat, they'll take something really mundane and figure out just how to make it uncanny enough to be scary.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it'll be interesting, or it will hold up better if it's not the last we see of this kind of idea of these things mimicking life on Earth and the great intelligence. If it comes back, then it will seem more together. If it's just this one-off thing, it feels really random and just thrown in there.
Right. I know, David, when you were on last time and we talked about the finale of the first half of the season and the penultimate episode, too, we talked about the that episode where the Doctor basically lives with the pawns and those cubes show up, the Power of Three, and then, you know, it just wraps up so quickly with the villain that the villain never really posed any kind of threat. It was just sort of like a second, sort of like an afterthought, really. And I agree with you, Amanda, like, if it doesn't have bigger implications in this season as a whole, then I didn't really find the villain particularly interesting. Like, visually, yeah, the snowmen were very cool, but it never really threatening. Although I did like that the Doctor's plan sort of backfired, at the very end when he used the worm to erase Simeon's memory, but then that just meant the consciousness of the snow could inhabit his body then. And I like that scene of, that shot of Simeon, like, holding the Doctor and freezing him, and it does this, like, overhead shot of the Doctor on the ground, like, sort of loosely gripping his sonic screwdriver and just sort of, I mean, dying, sort of. I thought that was kind of cool that it established that he does need a companion, that he can't do it all by himself. So I like that aspect of it.
It reminded me again of back to, you know, episode one with Rose, where he was going to die had she not swung in there.
Yeah, absolutely. Or even with Martha, the... Martha's first season when he's drowning the spider lady and like is kind of losing himself in doing that, and then she or no not it wasn't Martha it was
Donna,
yeah, and then Donna kind of gets him out of there. So yeah, I thought that was cool, but yeah, overall I just didn't, the villain didn't really do much for me either way.
Usually in a season, like, you know, they'll have some little one-off episodes, but there's an ongoing theme, and I'm wondering what the heck the theme is supposed to be for this season. Because I don't know where it is.
Right, yeah, I agree. Although I think this did a great job of getting you kind of primed and ready for the second half of the season. I think the last Christmas special didn't really do much of that at all. And it was actually kind of bad. I didn't like the last Christmas special.
No?
No, it was fine, but like it felt like it didn't go anywhere, and I didn't really feel much tension in it. Like, it was just sort of middle of the road for me.
Those kids crying about their dead dad, that didn't get you?
A little bit, but then, like, he comes back, and, you know, it's like, of course, and I don't know. I just felt there wasn't much suspense when they were actually in that the forest and stuff. Like, you just, I don't know. It didn't do much for me, but I thought this was a wonderful Christmas special. I think the best of Matt Smith's Christmas specials.
I agree with that, yeah. It's definitely the best. Anything that they do with Victorian stuff is going to be pretty great. They know what they're doing.
Sure. David, how did you feel about the snowmen villains, or just the snowmen villains?
They felt just kind of forced into the episode, kind of like as you mentioned earlier, the Cube episode. It really would have stood on its own without them. It would have been harder to introduce Clara to the Doctor without this, you know, looming threat, but they didn't feel very threatening. They're just, you know, snow.
Right. And the very beginning, we see that scene where he lets the snowman eat all those people who help him collect the snow. And I guess that's to establish that they're deadly. But other than that, we don't really see them do anything.
But then, you know, he tells the young girl, he tells Clara, you know, just imagine the melting. And then they melted.
Right.
You know, if that's the biggest villain that you've got, then
No, I agree. That part really wasn't suspenseful, but luckily there was so much other good stuff going on that didn't really matter.
And yeah.
I said it before last time we talked, but I really think episodes of Doctor Who would be totally fine without, like, a villainous threat. I really think they could do an episode that's just, like, entirely character-driven, and it would work. But I know that that's just, it's not in the DNA of the show. Like, every episode has to have some kind of evil force that the Doctor is working against.
Well, they always have this balance that they have to work out of character development and adventure. And if they do it the right way, the threat moves forward the character development. They're in a situation where they're going to have to sort out their crap in order to solve the problem.
Right.
But if those two things aren't in harmony, it's just going to feel a little bit off.
Yeah. So, the villains weren't bad, but yeah, it definitely took, like, a backseat to everything else that was going on. I thought the episode opened up, like, with a lot going on at once. I was kind of happy. I think it really slows down once Oswin first discovers the ladder to the TARDIS and climbs up it. But, like, the first 15 minutes, I felt like there was so much going on that I didn't really have a good grasp of, like, what was going on. You know, we've got the shot of the little kid in the 1800s, like, first finding the snow, and then he's collecting the snow. You don't really know why. The Doctor is just randomly walking down an alleyway, and Oswin sees him, and they're talking about the snow, and it was just a lot going on at once. But I thought it did a really good job of kind of slowing down and allowing the story to breathe once she found the TARDIS.
What did you think of his costume?
I liked it. You know, I thought it was pretty good. I liked the return of the bow tie once he's sort of in a better mood. And sort of his realization that he put it on, and then kind of commenting that it is cool and kind of getting in better spirits and stuff.
But, oh, that bit cracked me up so
much. Yeah, it was very good when they were talking about how it's getting cool in the room. And it is kind of cool, isn't it? Bow ties are cool. Yeah, that was great.
He reminds me of the way he plays it. You ever watch Adventure Time?
Yeah, a little bit.
The kid Finn, like, he just seems like a grown-up Finn sometimes to me.
Sure.
All he cares about is being cool and going on the adventure, and it's pretty much like three tracks of thought for him.
Right, like sort of oblivious to what's going on around him.
He really is an 8-year-old.
Yeah, for sure. So yeah, I thought that was great. But yeah, the new costume is cool. What do you guys think about the TARDIS redesign? You only see it for a kind of a brief moment when Oswin goes into the TARDIS, but I mean, what'd you guys think? I kind of miss the old TARDIS, but...
I really dig it. It's my favorite of the ones so far.
Really?
Yeah, usually in the past, I mean, I always liked the other ones because they didn't look like what you thought a spaceship would look like on the inside. But I like that this is, it actually does look like one on the inside, but it's got, like, still some pretty unique elements, and I like how they have, like, Gallifreyan on there now, and it's really offsetting that the door's on the other side, though.
Yeah, that's for sure. But yeah, no, I agree. It seems like the most serious of the interior designs, and maybe that's to reflect his, you know, recent serious stint where he's been kind of alone and angry. But yeah, it's very sort of sterile, but it does look the most like appropriate, I guess, for a spaceship. I definitely agree with that.
Yeah, it feels like a little bit of 2001, and it looks a little bit like some of the old TARDISes, but it's like, I was telling Mike, I felt like it looked like what they would have made the old TARDISes look like back in the day if they knew or had that budget.
Sure.
But yeah, I think like you said too, it matches his mood. The other one felt warm and inviting. It felt like cozy, like you're going in a hobbit hole, and this one feels like you're going into a doctor's office.
That's true, which in a way I guess you are. What'd you think, David? Any thoughts about the redesign?
I actually really do like it. It's got that metallic look, mm-hmm. and I'm a sucker for that. Also, lots of lights.
Yeah.
You know, the orange/reddish tint was nice in the old one, but this one's more white and, you know, the control panel, there are a few shots, it's organized, like, the other one was more playful, obviously, but this one, it seems more mechanical, and that draws into the whole what you think a spaceship would look like.
Sure. Yeah, it's very clean.
It's very different, but it's refreshing almost.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
To see something new.
Sure. Yeah, I'm excited to see some more of it as, you know, as the episodes go on and we see more interior shots.
Well, you know they're doing an episode called Journey to the Center of the TARDIS. So,
oh, really?
Yeah, that'll be really freaking cool.
That's awesome. That's not the one directed by Neil Gaiman, is it?
No, he's doing The Last Cyberman.
Oh, that's right. He's doing a Cyberman one, yeah. Because I know, you know, his last episode was the Doctor's Wife, which
was about the TARDIS. Oh, it's so great.
So, I know, it was a wonderful episode, so. And then, Amanda, as a fan of the old stuff, you must have been psyched with the new show intro then.
Oh, yeah, they brought back the face.
The face, and then even, like, the TARDIS coming straight to the camera and the doors opening, like, to go into the episode.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was all very cool. But the face, specifically, I saw that, and I was like, oh, wow, they went back to it.
Yeah, just in time for the 50th. That's super cool.
Yeah, I thought that was neat.
I like that they're kind of, because it felt like, and understandably, when it came out first in 2005, you know, they wanted to distance themselves from it and be like, this ain't your granddaddy's Doctor Who.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, now they can kind of acknowledge that they can embrace certain aspects of it.
Right. Well, I think they've acknowledged that their fan base wants that, and their fan base is open to it. I mean, yeah, when you start off fresh like that, they kind of had to do something new because they needed it to be successful. But now I think they know that fan base loves classic Who as much as they love new Who, so it works.
Mm-hmm.
So we're nearing the end here, but we need to spend some time with our crazy theories about Oswin. Amanda, I know in the email chain you specifically said she better not be a ghost or you're going to be very mad.
Yeah.
So talk about, I mean, it seems like you probably have theories, so talk a little bit about what you're thinking.
I don't have any theories, particularly. I just read dumb theories on Tumblr.
Sure.
But, I mean, the only thing I was thinking is I try to look for a pattern in the way that Stephen Moffat writes,
mm-hmm.
and it seems like he screws with you so bad. Like, he'll put the most obvious statements in there that give the whole thing away, but you just weren't listening to it because it was something dumb and it was a throwaway line. So when she just said, I don't believe in ghosts, I was like, damn it, if she ends up being a ghost because of this one line, I'm going to flip out. But, no, the things I've heard are all really far-fetched. Like, they don't seem plausible. Like, one was that, what if she, do you remember the face of Bo? And how the face of Bo was pregnant at one point. So the one theory was that she's the child of the face of Bo.
Mm-hmm.
And so, oh. You know, she bears somewhat of a resemblance to him. She's kind of flirtatious and has the same attitude. She's very brilliant. So that was one thought. Another one that I don't see it being possible at all, but it was that she's the daughter of Rose and the duplicate doctor, and she's come through to the other side.
Hmm. Okay.
I don't know. So if anything, knowing Moffat is a fucking ghost.
Yeah, I know people want to see those ties to the stuff from Tenet's Doctor, but I just don't see it being either the face of Bo or Rose and the Doctor's child. It seems like this Matt Smith Doctor has been very far removed from, like, what happened with David Tennant. So I have a hard time believing that they would pull from that. I could see them.
They don't do it for anything else, so why would they pull this one random time?
For this huge major plot point. Yeah, I don't think it's gonna happen.
The closest I could see is that it would be Jenny, but at this point, that doesn't make sense, because she would have regenerated or something.
Right. Yeah, it doesn't seem like it's anything like that. I had two thoughts. When you mentioned the ghost thing, I did think, like, maybe it's some sort of weird, like, echo through time. Like, there is one true Osmond somewhere, and then, like, somehow, like, her consciousness is, like, trapped and, like, repeating in time somehow.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe she is a ghost, like, trapped in time.
I've just got to say, if she is a ghost, then how is she also a Dalek? You know, you got to think about that whole, in the Asylum of the Daleks.
That's true. She had to, well, but I don't know. She had a physical form in this episode, so I assume maybe she could somehow be turned into a Dalek still.
Or there's that whole thing with the Great Intelligence. If that's going to come back, I mean, in the old show, that was like an intelligence that could take bodily forms, like take them over.
Mm-hmm.
So if that's coming back, maybe she's not even a person to begin with. She's the Great Intelligence, and she's just choosing this form.
Right, and that was my second thought, is that maybe she's something created by something we haven't seen yet that's trying to maybe trap the Doctor or, like, trick him. Like, maybe she's been specifically created to allure the Doctor. I mean, it's, you know, it's a young woman. There's a mystery tied to her. I mean, there's a lot going on there that could be maybe used to, like, try to capture him or trick him or do something.
Maybe she's the master.
Maybe. Maybe.
That's what my joke was last year. And I'm going to... Last year, my campaign was Rory is the master. This year, it's Oswin is the master.
keep bringing it back.
Yeah, every year, somebody's the master.
And then, to your ghost fear, I wonder if there could be something to that. Because when she falls, you know, from the cloud in the TARDIS and lands and... what's her face? I can't think of it. But, you know, uses her little, like, wristwatch to scan for life signals and says there is none.
Oh, shit, you're right!
And yet, when they bring her back, like, she's still alive. And I know, Strax is using something on her to, like, try to bring her back. But that totally, right there, could tell you, like, maybe she never was alive, you know?
Mm.
Like, so.
There is also, at the very end, that scene in the graveyard where, you know, it's got her tombstone, and she's walking right by it.
Yeah.
So
as much as you don't want it to be a ghost, it could be something. It could
fucking
be something.
Fucking Moffat.
Like, I guess we'll see.
Such an asshole.
He is, but at least he gave us that awesome Sherlock crossover, so I'll forgive him for everything.
Oh yeah, I don't really hate him. I just feel like he loves trolling the idiots.
He does. He really does. So yeah, I think that brings us to the end. Overall, it sounds like all of us were very impressed with this episode, and can't wait for more. So, Amanda, maybe come April, once the show returns, you know, you're welcome to come back and talk some more Who.
I would love to.
Yeah,
as long as you tolerate me.
Yes, we will do our best. So yeah, Amanda, thanks for being here, and David, you too.
Thank you for letting me join.
Of course, of course. And if anyone out there has any Who thoughts, feel free to post them in the TalkBack thread. And, yeah, we'll see you guys later.